Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. It's pretty safe to say that the internet is here to stay. But like all young, world-changing technologies, the jury is still out on whether the power and the promise of the internet will play out in any foreseeable way. The digital world often divides people into two camps. Those who see the internet as a democratic utopia, where traditional capitalist power structures get flattened, and others who see it as an anti-social medium where marketers and intelligence agencies collect our personal data for nefarious purposes. Astra Taylor has a more nuanced view. The documentary filmmaker behind Zizek and Examined Life has a new book out. It's called The People's Platform, Taking Back Power and Culture in the Digital Age. Astra, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Cool. Thank you for having me.
Well, you've said that one of the reasons you wanted to write this book came out of wanting to examine the language of Silicon Valley, how people talk about the internet in those early days before Google and Facebook. And how has that panned out, in your opinion?
Well, so much of the language we use to describe not just what the internet is, but what we want it to be, is imported from Silicon Valley. So we talk about openness, transparency, participation, and these are really powerful words and they're appealing, but they can mean different things depending on who's speaking. So Mark Zuckerberg can say he wants to make the world more open and connected, but that means us as the users of his social media service revealing all the details of our personal lives and all of our connections to other human beings so that he can better help advertisers track and monitor and sell things to us. So open. The more open we are, in a way, the more vulnerable we are, and the more that we're giving a kind of power away to these platforms that, well, they were the underdogs and they were these sort of upstarts not that long ago, less than a decade ago. They're now the most powerful corporations in the world, and increasingly they're moving to monitor us, not just at the keyboard, on our computers or on our cell phones, but in everyday, you know, quote unquote, real life.
Well, some of the things that we do choose is creative work, music, writing, YouTube tutorials, things we think of as free, but which you call a form of corporate subsidy. What do you mean by that?
You know, we see this problem in the broader economy. It's not something that's just unique to the internet, where there's growing inequality. And where corporate profits are at an all-time high and less returns are going to workers and to middle-class Americans. And these technologies are another avenue for that, where we all engage, we are all contributing value, and yet the value is being extracted and going to a small handful of people. I mean, it's amazing that these companies, they're some of the biggest in the world in terms of their market capitalization. Google and Apple are up there vying for the top position, but they have remarkably few employees. They're not like the old companies of yore where, you know, a company was incredibly valuable and employed hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people and gave them livelihoods. These companies employ very few people. I mean, WhatsApp was bought for $19 billion, and I think it had about 100 employees or something. So there's structurally something very interesting going on that has big implications.
So do you use those free services? Do you use Gmail? Do you use other services that you don't have to pay for, but you are, as you're suggesting, somehow paying for?
Right. So those free services should always have free in quotes because we always pay with our privacy because the business model of the internet is surveillance if you're not paying with money out of your own pocket. So a mix because these services are so essential to modern life that it's hard to get off them. And I wouldn't want to because, you know, I see all of their utility and the pleasures, too. So, you know, I use Twitter. I'm on Twitter. I'm not an avid Facebook user. I have started paying for my email provider. I don't use Gmail anymore. I use a company called Fastmail. And it just felt to me that it was worth paying what is really a trivial amount in order to have a service that doesn't scan the contents of my emails and try to serve me advertisements. So it's a mix. But one thing I think is important as an independent filmmaker who's trying to get the word out about her films and stuff is I part of the reason I don't invest a huge amount of time into investing into Facebook and building an audience and getting, you know, as many friends as possible is because they can change their terms of service. They can rejig their algorithms. And ultimately, all of that work that I did, all of that investment could be for naught. And again, we're seeing that as people are complaining that they're reaching a smaller and smaller percentage of their community and being asked to pay to reach the rest of them. So, you know, you can put an enormous amount of time and energy into these platforms, and they're not beholden to you. Ultimately, they can change at any moment.
We're speaking with the documentary filmmaker and now author, Astra Taylor. She says the internet has not lived up to its promise of being a liberating democratic force, and that the disruptive impact of the web has been uneven at best, in her words. Her new book is called The People's Platform, Taking Back Power and Culture in the Digital Age. Now, here's a pretty unusual concept that you write about, nationalizing Facebook. Now, what purpose would that serve, and how would a nationalized Facebook look differently from the one we use now?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure I actually say that we should nationalize Facebook. I say that, you know, there's a resistance to the idea of truly public or socialized services, but that it's ironic because we talk about these sites and services as though they already were public. So obviously online we say things are social. But that means that they're open to people that we can share things. It, of course, doesn't mean that they're socialized or whatever. But there's a sense that we actually want these services, or we want something online that resembles a public park and not just a shopping mall. And that's what I'm actually highlighting. The idea of nationalizing the internet doesn't make any sense. Even if it does make sense to talk about treating the companies that provide us access to the internet as public utilities. And what does that mean? That means that just as phone companies, old landlines, had certain common carrier obligations that they had to take and receive calls equally, and that it was recognized that they were crucial for social life, I believe ISPs should be thought of in the same way. So it's not actually such a radical thought. It gets a little more radical when you go from the level of infrastructure to the level of services that we're using, like Facebook, and you say, okay, we want some sort of public space. We speak of Twitter as a town square, or Facebook as a town square, as places of protest, right? But actually, they're commercial spaces, and they're not really beholden to the civic values. So, you know, what could we do to create more parks on the internet, so it's not just a world of shopping malls?
You talk about needing to carve out a new form of digital public media. Now, aren't crowdfunding platforms like Kickstarter, or despite all its flaws, websites like Wikipedia already a form of digital public media? What are you looking for?
Yeah. Wikipedia is an example that is most commonly invoked. It's probably the most popular example. And it's often held up as kind of almost the platonic ideal of what the internet could be. But we have to recognize that it's very unique. It's actually the only nonprofit, non-commercial site that is in the top 100 sites of, like, most popular sites on the internet. So
Wow. We
love it. We talk about it. We invoke it all the time. But actually, it's really rare. So I think a worthwhile question is why there aren't more sites like that, you know, if we think that it brings so much value. And part of the problem for any non-commercial site is funding. And so I think it's absolutely true that crowdfunding services like Kickstarter and Indiegogo and all these things can be really useful. And in fact, I've been part of campaigns that have raised money on those sites. But I think we actually do need something that is a collective funding mechanism for important social goods like journalism.
So what does that look like?
It could look like funding structures that exist in to fund NPR or to fund the CBC or to fund the BBC. I mean, there were moments where in our past where people got so sick of the commercialism on TV and the fact that the lines between advertising and editorial were so blurred. So back in the days around the time of the Quiz Show scandal and you know, the days when soap operas sold soap, that people organized and started trying to insert a sort of firewall between those two. And then that gave rise to a push for slowly over time for public media, for explicitly non-commercial spaces. And so a lot of those principles still apply in this day and age. I think it's about creating media in a time of scarcity. So it's not forcing people to look at public media over anything else, but making sure there is more public media in the mix. And there are plenty of strategies for funding this kind of content that limit the government's influence and all of these concerns people have.
Well, I think of sites like ProPublica or the Center for Public Integrity, for example, that are doing investigative journalism, among others. But I also think about that idea of having public funding devoted that way. You know, that's something that we come up against in public media when political tides change, you know, wanting to take
right.
the money away.
Yeah, and that's a risk. But it's also risky to depend on the patronage of wealthy people and billionaires, so because they can be fickle too. And, you know, people often worry that investing in public media would actually be less democratic because it would be state-sponsored, and that raises some alarms. But you know, plenty of groups have shown that actually the countries with the highest investment in public media are generally the most democratic. And I'm talking about the magazine, for example, The Economist, which is hardly some crazy left-wing magazine, has a democracy index. And the countries that rank at the top of that list that they believe are the most democratic, have the most economic freedom, tend to have really generous state subsidies for news. I mean, often, you know, we spend about $1.50 a person. Some of these countries, like Norway, spend over $100 per citizen. And that's because then the paradox is that the more robust the investment in public media, the more the public media can push back on the government, on corporate interests, and actually do the job of independent journalism. And for some reason, we like to ignore those other examples.
Well, we definitely don't have the majority view. I mean, we know that people, in fact, even talking about developing public media is a little bit like saying you better eat your broccoli, even though we're at a buffet full of, you know, cupcakes and desserts. You know, people pick up the cupcakes and desserts on the internet, right?
Yeah, but, you know, not always. I think the thing is that you have to have both options visible to even choose the broccoli. And there's a way in which the current model, the sort of commercial and advertising driven news sites, get into a sort of feedback loop where they're just offering the candy, they're just offering the quick clicks because that's what they need to stay afloat. And you know, I've talked to some journalists, and actually it's in the book, where they say, actually, you know, when you go deeper and you offer something different and offer something that has a longer lifespan, it's not just of the moment, you know, whatever's trending in the search engine or whatever celebrity has tripped on the red carpet or whatever, people will look at it. It might take more time. The value might not be immediately apparent. But I think if you trust the intelligence of your listeners and your viewers, people will make more diverse choices.
Astra, you write about the problem of online power structures requiring collective political action. But short of dedicating our lives to the cause, what are some of the consumer or user choices that people can make differently that might put the internet back in the hands of the people, as your book hopes for?
I think the most urgent thing for people to get involved in is the struggle for net neutrality, because there are worrying signs from the FCC that they're going to do an about-face on that and essentially transform what has been a fundamental characteristic of the net and one of its most democratic traits, which is that all data is treated equally. So a large site like Amazon.com can load as fast as my personal website. And they're looking into allowing fast lanes that are paid for by companies that have deep enough pockets to do that. So that's a struggle that's really easy to join. There are many nonprofits and activist groups that are doing everything from online petitions to organizing protests. This is an issue that is really coming to a head around the globe. There are massive street protests around a bill that would also eliminate net neutrality in Mexico, and people are forming a human chain and really fighting back. So that's something that doesn't need to take up your entire life, but could have huge implications for our society down the road.
Astra Taylor, documentary filmmaker behind Zizek and The Examined Life. Her new book is called The People's Platform, Taking Back Power and Culture in the Digital Age. Astra, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for taking the time. I appreciate it.
Now you'll find more on her book online at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Each year, tens of thousands of NASCAR enthusiasts flock to the New Hampshire Motor Speedway to catch the country's most famous race car drivers. The state is also home to elite racing of a different sort and size. Slot car racing. For the fourth year in a row, a local slot car enthusiast has helped his team capture the world record for distance traveled in 24 hours by a car the size of an iPhone. Sean Hurley recently visited Dickie Pearson, owner of Slot Car Corner in Penacook, fresh off his world record race at the Michigan 24, and brings us the story.
Claudio Serrano is late to the race. He sets his briefcase down, planted safely in the foam molding. He introduces me to his four favorite cars.
So I can say that this one is good, this one is excellent, this is top of the line, this one is terrible. The important thing is that I have a lot of fun with this, that doesn't matter how bad or how good I do, it's the fun.
Every Saturday, Serrano races against his friends on the 78-foot-long copper-braided track that takes up most of the floor space of Slot Car Corner, a hobby shop in downtown Penacook. After selecting his car, Serrano readies his trigger finger.
The finger needs some exercise, so...
Serrano joins the eight other people gathered around the track's swooping black ribbon to watch Philip Basaldu lose to his 11-year-old daughter, Raven.
Does she usually beat him?
Yes, she does.
How does that happen?
Because she's better than me.
Even though I keep on crashing.
Little Corvettes and BMWs shoot down the straightaway and regularly fly off the tight corner where the reigning world record holder, Dickie Pearson, fetches the cars off the floor and resets them on the track.
And it's funny to watch other people when they first started get going and start really getting into it, they'll squeeze that trigger so hard that their hand hurts at the end of a race. It doesn't take long to be consistent. It does take a while to become really good, a lot to practice to get the most out of the car.
While Slot Car Corner is open on the weekends, it's mostly an online store. Pearson and his partner, Steve Sautel, sell everything from tiny replacement drivers to their own brand of silicon and aluminum tires.
A lot of guys want to take it to the next level. They want to get rid of the magnet because it's more challenge to drive or drive fast. So we offer a lot of hop-up parts and tires to help the car run smoother.
Claudio Serrano buys his hopped-up tires here. He waits in the pit for Bob Bianchi to finish his race.
I will say congratulations, Bob, but you were in last place.
We were.
Serrano doesn't mean the last heat, but one of the biggest races in the country for 1/32nd scale slot cars, the Michigan 24, where Dickie Pearson took the checkered flag.
It's a good chance to pick on Bob here. Usually about every 10 laps I was passing Bob at Michigan.
Bob Bianchi's team Can-Am had trouble the moment the Michigan race began. Bianchi blames himself. He'd picked the car. He'd done all the prep work.
But it's a Saturday night racer, and it just couldn't take it. We broke guides, we broke chassis, we broke the screws that hold in the front axle pulled out. We had an awful lot of problems. It just couldn't survive.
Last year, the six-man Slot Car Corner team, anchored by Pearson, set the 24-hour world record at 269.46 miles. This year, they went faster and further, 271.71 miles. While Bianchi blames his car, he also credits Pearson.
No matter where he goes, no matter what the track, no matter what controller he's using, he seems to take very short time, and he's driving very fast. So I always tease him. I tease him. He's a robot. The controller's just there to throw us off track. He's actually connected into his circuitry.
There are world records that make headlines and make you famous. And there are world records that hardly anyone will ever know about and don't change your life much at all. The Michigan 24 takes place in a basement. Team Slot Car Corner's world record is noted pretty much exclusively on a British slot car website. And while most of Saturday evening's race talk quickly veers into jokes about Bob Bianchi's tragic last place finish, everyone here at least knows who won the big race, who has the world record. For Word of Mouth, I'm Sean Hurley.
gets the hot chicks cause they think he's cool. He used to go to my high school. He's the king of the slot car track. He got a cannon.
Stay with us for a conversation that will leave you itching for more. How to identify pesky, poisonous rash plants. Turns out, not as easy as you might imagine. That's after the news, when Word of Mouth continues, from NHPR.
So don't you mess around. He's the fastest trigger in this here town. Look out, buddy, he'll shut you down. He gets the hot chicks because they think he's cool. He used to go to my high school. He's the king.
Word of
mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Leaves of Three, Let It Be. Kids and city slickers alike know the rhyme for identifying poison ivy. But how about poison sumac or oak? Even experienced hikers can have a tough time separating poisonous plants from harmless vegetation when deep in the woods. Tyra Johnson is a field biologist and founder of the e-learning company Nature Digger. The Nature Digger app, Rash Plants, provides a comprehensive pocket guide to identifying and dealing with outdoor irritants. Tyra, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you.
Why do you think so many of us have such a hard time deciphering poison ivy, even after so many have suffered with the consequences of brushing up against it?
Well, I think to understand poison ivy, you need to stop looking at what is out there on the internet. Believe it or not, there's so much misinformation out there. You really can't rely on any specific standard when it comes to poison ivy. It looks like so many other plants. It looks just like a black raspberry, for example, with the three leaflets. It's really difficult to identify unless you truly look and understand that it can look like other plants and not necessarily always the same.
So I guess you're making the case that your Rash Plants app, of course, can identify it. How does it work?
You should be an expert by the time you go through this app. I have over 600 very high-resolution photos in the app. Each gallery is set up so that you can touch a picture, and then you can touch the little eye in the corner, and it will give you further information about it. It's just a little bit of text that kind of explains what you're seeing. There is also a quiz that changes every time, so you can go through and test your knowledge and see how you do.
Quiz that changes every time we take it. I'm trying to figure out what more is there to say about poison ivy, Tara?
Well, the biggest, I think, misconception is people feel that they'll find it in a particular habitat when it actually is in almost every habitat. You're looking at disturbed areas like roadsides, field margins where fields meet the woods, your driveway, of course. Anywhere that has been any type of a disturbance, you're going to find poison ivy. It's a pioneer species, so where there's been disturbance, it will be one of the first plants to come in, which is actually a good thing, too, because it prepares the soil for more desirable plants who might not be able to make it otherwise. But that is the area, the habitat, that I think you should really be looking at rather than, it's just generally in the woods. And it also grows in three different, what I would consider growth habits, I call it that in the app. And it's a low, low ground cover. It's also a vine, a very hairy vine. If you're driving down the highway, you can see it from, a distance at 55 miles an hour. And it's also a shrub.
Plenty of poison ivy, especially here in New England. What about the other rash plants, poison oak or poison sumac? They are not so easy to identify.
Well, we don't need to worry about poison oak here. That is something that the western states, California, Oregon, they are worried about the Pacific poison oak over there. I traveled over there to take photos for the app and to learn about it over there. And it's actually easier to identify, I think, than poison ivy. Down south, we have the Atlantic cousin to the Pacific poison oak. And that one's pretty easy to identify, too. I saw some variations, but nothing like poison ivy.
I also noticed on the app some FAQs. Tell us something we don't know about rash plants.
Well, an interesting, I think it's very interesting. Toxicodendron is the genus, and that has the poison ivy, oak, and sumac. They have male and female plants. So the female will create the berries, which birds and other wildlife will eat and spread and create new colonies. And the male is basically just there for pollination. If you have a female vine, all you need to do is cut it. Just cut it with your regular garden clippers, and you will avoid spreading possibly thousands of berries into other people's yards and your own yard and all over the place, because those birds will take it and off they go.
That's good to know that there are ways to get rid of it when it's in our yard. But how about when we do brush up against it? Dealing with a poison ivy rash doesn't leave a lot of options. Does the app offer any treatment suggestions?
It definitely does. The rash and remedy section is extensive. I have offered what I find to be probably the most effective over-the-counter remedies, also remedies that you can find just in your kitchen, and Mother Nature remedies. I have found a specific plant in New Hampshire that grows here everywhere that is one of the best remedies for the rash, and it works almost immediately, and it's called sweet fern.
What should we do immediately if we know that we've contacted poison ivy?
The very first thing you should do is wash with very cold water. Never hot water. It opens up the pores, and it allows that oil to come into your pores a little more readily. So you definitely want to use the cold water. And Dawn dish detergent is a really great degreaser. And since it's called urushiol oil that is in the canals of the leaves and the berries, that particular oil is broken down by Dawn dish detergent. So it's an easy, quick wash when you find out that you've done it. If you can get it within 10 minutes, generally you should be okay. If it goes beyond that, you're looking at possibly alleviating the symptoms, but maybe not completely resolving them.
Tara, I have to say, I don't think I've ever had poison ivy in my life, and I think I'm one of those people who is not allergic. Is that possible?
It's not necessarily possible for life. There are so many theories about sensitivity, and that is that A, your pot gets full, where you have just had enough exposure, and the next time you come in contact with it, you may get the rash. You may not have had enough contact with the urushiol oil to have your body elicit a response to it. So you might need more. I need a pinprick, whereas some people might need a little more than that to actually get their body to go, whoa, we have something foreign here.
So poison ivy myth number 564. Can you actually spread it from one person to another?
No, you cannot spread it from one person to another. If you have fresh oil on your skin, on your hands, you've just touched it, you've crushed it, and you touch somebody else, yes. But no, it doesn't spread. And when those blisters do form after a couple of days, if you have a pretty severe case, what comes out of those is blood plasma. It is not urushiol oil. It is not contagious. Once you have the rash and the blisters have appeared, it is gone. That oil is so far gone by that point. But there is one very important thing to consider, though, and that is recontamination year after year. Urushiol can stay on, like, sports equipment, gardening tools, things that you use every year and you don't realize you're using them on poison ivy. You store them away and then you pull them out the next year, you wind up with poison ivy and you have no idea why. That is why, because that will stick to your garden tools and all of your equipment for years unless you wash it.
Tip from field biologist Tara Johnson. Many, many more on the Rash Plant app from Nature Digger. Tara, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
The new app Rash Plant is available for iOS at the App Store. From tracking fitness and photo editing to games and restaurant reviews, there are more than 750,000 apps available for our smartphones and tablets. Thanks to one occupational therapist, some of these apps have also had a dramatic impact on people with autism. Elliot Majerzik reports.
That's a smartphone app called Clock, with a robot reminder that alerts you it's time to do something on your schedule. For a lot of us, apps like these help us navigate daily life, but they're becoming essential for many people with autism in the workplace.
The things that make you incapable of maintaining a job once you get it, a lot of times are just being able to hit your marks, show up on time, take your breaks on time, have your lunch on time, do those kinds of things.
Tony Gentry is the Director of Assistive Technology at Virginia Commonwealth University. He finds just the right apps that people with autism might need on the job.
Because so much of what they typically like to do is routine-based, having these systematic reminders all day long, clocking them along, helps them feel calmer, more secure, and gets them able to switch from one task to another at the appropriate time. Those are challenges they face without the alarms. With the alarms, they can be independent.
And it's not just reminder apps. Tony tells the story of how he modified a video app on an iPod Touch for a young man who was working in a hospital.
His job is to stock the crash carts in the intensive care unit. He's got at least 100 items to put in each one of the crash carts. So what he has now is a two-minute video that shows each drawer that he has to fill with all the items in it. He never misses anymore. He's got it all down. He walks up to his supervisor at the end of the day, shows them his iPod Touch, and she says, oh, you did carts 1 through 10 today. That means you'll start with number 11 tomorrow. She knows where he's at, he knows where he's at, and we're good to go with that.
Tony says the beauty of these apps is in their consistency.
People with autism seem to prefer, and I'm speaking stereotypically here, but seem to prefer learning from computers to learning from humans. The computer is always going to be the same, and that trustworthiness to computers as compared to human beings, I think, is something that folks with autism rely on.
Though it may sound expensive, in the long run, providing an iPod Touch to people with autism in the workplace is cost-effective.
Once they're trained to use the device, their need for job coaching support drops off dramatically, and we're building a sense of independence and self-efficacy for the person in the workplace, and that's the kind of thing you can't buy.
I'm Elliot Majerczyk.
And just a program note here, if you're heading for the great outdoors, make sure and tune into our program tomorrow when we'll be looking at all range of experiences in the big, big world outside. That's tomorrow on Word of Mouth. And on a much less cheery but very important note, this month marks the 20th anniversary of the Rwandan genocide. Up next, we're going to hear the story of Raphael Lemkin. He was a Polish lawyer of Jewish descent who first coined the term genocide back in 1944. We're going to learn about how groundbreaking providing that legal term was and still is today when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott, and we're about to discuss genocide, something that sensitive listeners may find disturbing, but that nonetheless continues in our contemporary world. Holocaust Remembrance Day ends tonight at sundown, and last week, millions around the world commemorated the Armenian Genocide of 1915. This month also marks the 20th anniversary of the Rwandan Genocide. A cruel month indeed for acknowledging man's inhumanity to man. Human history has been stained by many similar incidences of barbarity, but the term genocide is a 20th century invention by a Polish lawyer of Jewish descent named Raphael Lemkin.
Most people don't believe that other people are capable of these kinds of crimes, even today. But Lemkin knew.
In Rwanda, up to 200,000 people have died in a month.
About 1.3 million Syrians have fled their country's bloody two-year conflict.
Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir has been accused of masterminding a campaign of genocide in Darfur.
Lemkin came up with the term in 1944. The UN adopted the Genocide Convention in 1948, marking the first time that the deliberate killing of a large group of people, especially those of a particular ethnic group or nation, could be prosecuted by international law. Still, the world that vowed never again after World War II mostly stood by in silence as thousands of Muslim boys and men were slaughtered at Srebrenica and nearly a million were killed in Rwanda, including the parents of Emmanuel Awurukundu, now a field officer in Chad for the UN.
My parents were killed in April, but my sisters were killed around June. It's not acceptable.
These are just some of the horrors that the subjects of the documentary film Watchers of the Sky are trying to prevent in the future. Watchers of the Sky debuted at Sundance earlier this year. It will be released in theaters next year. I caught a screening at the Monadnock International Film Festival in Keene earlier this month and got to meet the film's director and producer, Edith Belzberg. Edith, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
So a little background first on Raphael Lemkin and what led him to a lifetime of, let's say, dogged commitment to addressing genocide.
Well, You know, Lemkin, this is something that consumed him since his childhood. You know, he was, unlike most kids, I think from a very early age, he was taken with moral tales that his mother was reading him, with Aesop's Fables and La Fontaine, and this stayed with him for the rest of his life, really. And when he read about the killings, the massacres of the Armenians, he really said to himself, how is this happening today? And that led him on a lifelong pursuit. And he asked himself the question at a very young age, why is the killing of a million a lesser crime than the killing of an individual?
It is such a story. This man forced from his own country when Hitler invades Poland.
Yes.
And by the way, among Hitler's generals, apparently, they said, you know, why do you think you can get away with this? And Hitler says, what did he say? Something like, you know, they did it in Armenia.
He said, well, who today remembers what happened to the Armenians?
Yeah.
Lemkin and Hitler took a very different lesson from the Armenian genocide. Mm-hmm. And the lesson Lemkin took was, how do I prevent this from happening to anybody ever again? And once it happened to him and his people, he not only wanted to protect himself and his family and his people, but he wanted to find a way to stop this from ever happening to anyone again and to protect humanity from this crime.
Well, that's what one of the things that we learn in the book from you have profiles of, you know, four other unbelievably courageous people fighting genocide in their own way, including Samantha Power. Mm-hmm. She wrote the Pulitzer Prize winning book, A Problem from Hell, about mm-hmm. genocide. Now she is U.S. ambassador to the U.N. Now, she tells us that there was not an existing crime to charge Hitler with for killing the Jews. Hey, really? Why couldn't he be charged?
Well, under the Nuremberg laws, he had to cross an international border. So as she says in the film, if Hitler would have only killed all the Jews of Germany, he technically would not have been convicted, or his generals would have been convicted of a crime against humanity in the books at that time. Mm. But it's because they crossed the borders, because they went into Poland and they went into other countries, that they then could be convicted. So that was what Lemkin took issue with. He said, my God, it shouldn't be legal to kill the people who, you know, in your own country.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what he worked against. It should be equally illegal for a leader to kill tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, you know, millions of his or own people, and Lemkin sought to make that a crime. He wanted to ensure that leaders could not kill their people with impunity, which is still something that we're struggling with today.
Right, and this is something we see borne out in the film. But there is this terrific sequence where we see Lemkin, his notes and his struggles to come up with a name for this long, terrible history of barbarism.
Mm-hmm.
Now, why was the word so important? What would that do?
Well, he really hoped that the word would bind humanity. He really believed that he could find that one word, if he could find the right word, that would be enough. He felt that if the word encompassed the horrors, that people would come together to stop it from happening again.
Mm-hmm.
And he really believed that words held that weight and held that power. Sadly, that was not the case. He coined the term genocide. It was used in Nuremberg, and then it was incorporated in the dictionary, and it was something he was, of course, to be very proud of, but he saw that it wasn't enough. And once he saw that it wasn't enough, that's when he turned his attention to creating the Genocide Convention and pushing that through the United Nations. And he, again, thought that would be enough to stop these crimes from happening again.
We're going to hear a little bit of a clip of Ben Ferenc at Nuremberg. But first, a little context. There's an exchange with a Nazi commander of the Einsatzgruppen. These are the death squads. Now, he tells the court that 90,000 people were killed under his command between June of 1941 and 1942. And then we'll hear from Ben Ferenc.
From the Einsatzkommandos, etwa 90,000 als liquidiert gemeldet worden.
The killing of defenseless civilians during a war may be a war crime, but the same killings are part of another crime, a graver one, if you will, genocide.
Now, Ben Ferenc met Lemkin at Nuremberg. What were his impressions of this guy?
You know, Lemkin had one goal. You know, he had one goal and one pursuit, and everyone who he met you know, he would badger with this one goal and one pursuit, which was to make genocide a crime. And so he was really badgering Ben at that time to incorporate it into the Nuremberg trials, because at that time, what they were able to try was crimes against humanity and war crimes. So genocide was not in the books. They couldn't do that. And so Ben at that time couldn't rewrite everything, even though he saw the legitimacy of Lemkin's goal. So what he did do is he used the word, and it was probably the first time the word had ever been used in a court in that setting, but he could not make genocide a crime. And it would only be until years later that genocide actually became a crime, and it is today, as we know, a crime, and it could be prosecuted in the International Criminal Court. But Ben's first impression, I think, were a very, you know, dogged individual, but also one who compromised his well-being for the pursuit of his goal. Mm-hmm. And I think that that made an impression on Ben. He felt his pain. He understood that this was a very pained individual. And I think that he felt, you know, compassion for him and respected him for what he was trying to do.
Yeah, describes him with worn suits and crumpled shirts.
Yeah.
We're talking about that character of Raphael Lemkin. He's the man who came up with the word genocide, which later gave the international community a legal framework for preventing and prosecuting this crime against humanity. The filmmaker Edith Belzberg is with us. Her documentary about Lemkin and four other people working tirelessly to hold today's perpetrators of genocide accountable is called Watchers of the Sky. It's going to be released next year. So by pigeonholing senators and statesmen at the time, Lemkin was able to get enough votes to help ratify the Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide. This is in, I think, 48.
Yes.
So how has it been invoked since then? You must prove that it is deliberate.
Yes, I mean, it's been invoked a few times. I mean, we've seen it with the case of, which is currently going on, of Ratko Mladic, who's responsible for the Serbian massacre, and thankfully, Luis Moreno Ocampo, who is a character in the film, he used it when he indicted Omar al-Bashir, the president of Sudan, for the crimes committed in Darfur. And so it's been invoked, thankfully, a few times. Unfortunately, we haven't seen Bashir arrested yet, even though he has been convicted of committing genocide and crimes
against
humanity. Right,
that's the thing. He can be indicted, but there is no real international, you know, police force that will go and arrest him. That's, I think part of this is about the will of the global superpowers, you know?
Yes, no, absolutely. And that's the problem that we currently face, is how, once these leaders are indicted, how do we arrest them? How do we bring them to face justice and to trial, and so that they no longer lead with impunity? And I think that's something that's important to remember about Lemkin, is he lobbied with the UN in 1948. It's almost unheard of. I mean, this is one individual. He didn't speak, English was not his native language. He didn't represent an organization or an institution or a country. He barely had an address to call his own. He was struggling financially, had very little money, and yet he spent every day going to the UN. Every day he went to the UN to lobby ambassadors and delegates to push forward this crime. And we, you know, and it makes one wonder, my God, this is one individual who is able to bring all the countries of the UN together to pass a resolution in 1948. And it's remarkable. And I think one of the reasons why Lemkin is, you know, a hero, an unknown hero of our time, is that he did this. He really gave his life for this cause, and I hope that we as a people can pick up this torch, this incredibly bright torch that this one man left.
Edith Belzberg, what a story. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
Edith Belzberg is an Academy Award-nominated documentary film director and producer. Her film, Watchers of the Sky, debuted at Sundance earlier this year and is in limited screenings until next year when it will be released. You can watch a trailer for the film and find out more about Raphael Lemkin and the four other remarkably courageous people profiled in the film. There are links at wordofmouthradio.org. Our thanks for your listening time and attention today. There's much more to hear and even to pass around at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also follow us, you can send us your feedback, or share your ideas for the program on Facebook and on Twitter. After all, it's the stories we tell via word of mouth that shape our world, our friendships, our ideas, and our perspectives. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please join us for more tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.